Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Usually the guests on this show are experts in their field. They've honed their skills of songwriting, their knowledge of quantum physics, their years in the field studying how fruit gives way to rot in order to earn their bona fides. Today's guest isn't an expert. She didn't spend years mastering a niche skill set. She spent 1 year, and today, earnestly dabbling in witchcraft, searching for a spark of magic in the world around her. My guest today is Diana Hellmuth. She is an award-winning author of a book about hiking, who decided to take a page, or several, out of the books of people who I look up to. A.J. Jacobs, Mary Roach, Elizabeth Gilbert, authors who spent time approaching a field as a complete novice in order to learn everything they could about it, to see how it might change them, to see what we can learn about ourselves through the challenge of transforming some integral part of our lives, to spark curiosity, to inspire the asking of questions and the seeking of answers. Now, as an author of a book both about and for those folks exactly like Diana, who are currently searching for a bit of magic and earnestly trying to go about cobbling together a spiritual life while avoiding problematic stereotypes or engaging in harmful buying practices or supporting anti-intellectualism, I was quite excited to both read her new book, The Witching Year, and to speak with the author herself, to see this world I've been part of for so many years through fresh eyes, to see what I can learn through someone else's transformative journey, and to see my own first steps reflected back at me. So, just in time for spooky season, here is Diana Hellmuth, author of The Witching Year. Diana Hellmuth, welcome to Head on Fire. Thanks so much for being here.
I am so excited to be here with you, Don. Cannot wait to chat.
So excited to speak with you. Now, usually, this podcast is a place where I talk to experts in overlooked, interesting, misunderstood fields. And normally these are people that have been doing the thing that I'm interviewing them about for years, decades even. They've got multiple advanced degrees in the subject or, all sorts of certifications and very illustrious bona fides. You are none of those things.
Correct. That's correct.
You wrote a book about being new and bad at something. So I love that. I'm very excited to speak with you. For people who do not know who you are, tell people who you are and what book you wrote.
So I am Diana Hellmuth, and I wrote a book called The Witching Year. Subtitle is A Memoir of Earnest Fumbling Through Modern Witchcraft. One of the jokes that can be made about this book is Don, you wrote a book called The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft. And effectively in this book, this is a chronicle of a dabbler, someone who was curious about witchcraft, grew up exposed to witchcraft, decided they wanted to go on a spiritual journey, didn't feel confident most of the time, but there's wins, there's misses. This is a deep dive into what it means to take a self-directed spiritual quest in today's day and age. So it's funny. It's sad at times. I wanted to be really honest about the things that go wrong, about how silly I felt a lot of the time, about how skeptical I felt about a lot of things, while also embracing the things that make a journey like this good. And of course, chose witchcraft because it's the fastest growing religion or spirituality. Whether or not it's a religion is very debatable in the world and doesn't show any signs of stopping. And it is extremely self-directed. So that's the book I wrote. And I think it's for anyone who's curious about witchcraft, but really for anyone who maybe grew up thinking spirituality was stupid and then is starting to chafe at that idea and is curious about what is out there. So if you want to see someone take that dive, this book is for you.
it lives in a literary canon alongside a lot of my other favorite types of books, books that I try to emulate as well. We seem to have a lot of the same favorite authors. AJ Jacobs, who actually gave you a blurb for your book. Mm-hmm. Very jealous of that.
Yeah, we definitely used The Year of Living Biblically as a foil, like, pretty honest.
Sure,
like,
yeah, sure.
Yeah.
The Year of Living Witchily.
Witchily, yeah.
But obviously, like, Mary Roach is in here. Elizabeth Gilbert can't be ignored. I mean, there's a lot of voices. I think people our age grew up reading, you know, that sort of mm-hmm. investigative, humorous, exploratory nonfiction.
Yeah.
We haven't seen a book like this in a while. It feels like about 10, 15 years ago, there were so many books that were like, I'm going to spend a year doing this and I'm going to write about it.
Right.
And this is an interesting, magical revival of that tradition. I do want to start, though. Why this book? why witchcraft? Why did you, Diana Helmuth, in the middle of a pandemic, like every other teenager with access to a piece of quartz, decide to pick up witchcraft during the Panini?
Right, during the Panini. Well, so there's sort of two answers to this. And I'll give the first one, which is less fun, but a little more surface level honest. So I was chatting with Lauren Parker and Maggie Ellison one day, who are two witches, two authors, and, you know, in their own rights, and are characters in the book. They're almost like my witchy fairy godmothers, kind of nudging me along when I need it, saving me from myself periodically, or getting me into trouble sometimes. We were chatting about the occult. I was upset about astrology. We were having a conversation about astrology. And I said, you know, I think actually I don't like astrology because I think it is against the very thing that it says it's doing. I think it advertises a self-discovery, but in fact is just telling people who they are based on things they can't control, mm-hmm. which doesn't really feel right. And Lauren was like, that's overly simplistic. That's not, you're misreading this willfully, you know. Anyway, we got to talking further and she said, do you know what would be really, really funny is if you tried to live astrologically for a year and wrote a book about it, because you have something stuck in your craw about this. And what is it? And Meg said, no, you know what you should really do? You should try and be a witch for a year, because that would be hilarious. Because I am, and I always was kind of attracted to witchcraft and
sure.
the occult, but then I felt that attraction made me there was a block. There was a huge internal block towards indulging it. And I called that side of myself logical and smart. And I wanted to be seen as very, you know, respectable. And by respectable, I mean someone who tolerates little bullshit and is not very imaginative and believes in science and that is separate from spirituality. So largely this book is a challenge of that entire part of myself. Like, I started the book and I had to dig a little deep. Like, why do I really want to do this? Why am I attracted to this? And I didn't realize how deep this prejudice in myself went until I started writing this book. Cause I thought I was going to be writing a book that was like, I'm going to make some jokes about crystals. I'm going to try praying. I can do that for a year, whatever. And then by the third month, it was like, oh, I was like, realized I had been thrown into a very deep pool, didn't know how to swim as well as I thought I did. And I had to dig really, really deep into some internal prejudices I had, into negative stereotypes about spiritual people, like not just witches, anyone religious. And why did I feel that way? Why did I associate wanting to be spiritual with shame? Which ended up taking up a huge chunk of the book. So this, yeah, it ended up being more than I thought I was getting into, which hopefully made for a more interesting story. But I guess that's for the readers to decide. Yeah.
At the very beginning of your journey, you kind of take a survey of the landscape of modern witchcraft and witchcraft practitioners and the ways that people find community, the ways that people research, the ways that people provide information, disseminate information, discuss that information.
Mm-hmm.
I did love this quote. I have a million of your quotes highlighted. but it said in right. something, but instead you're talking about how you thought that this was going to be a journey into something ancient, something mystical, something old, which is what I think a lot of people get into this type of spirituality or spiritual journey, hoping that they will find is lots of dusty tomes and ancient hags and corners of bookstores without names that appear mysteriously and point you to the true secrets of everything. But what you say is, quote, instead, we are following the glow of computer screens towards teenagers with opinions.
Yes.
So what did you think of, and I think we just kind of talked about this, but what did you think about witchcraft before any of this started? And what were those first, what was that first survey like, that initial foray into the world as it exists right now? And what did that tell you? Did it immediately make you want to like call Simon and Schuster and say, goodbye, no thank you, here's your money back, I do not want to write this book?
A little bit. I mean, I definitely had that moment while writing the book several times where I was like, I would like to get off the ride now. And I think if I hadn't fought very hard to write a book about this topic and been fortunate enough to have been paid to do so, I probably would have gotten off the ride, but I didn't. Which I think there's something to be said for accountability in a spiritual journey, even if it's a self-directed one. Because when things get tough, you want to stop. And if you push through, sometimes really amazing things can happen. But to answer your question, when I first started, I was overwhelmed by the amount of material on witchcraft that was available, which also, honestly, your book, The Dabbler's Guide, which I had had before because I had just, I think I had bought it previously because it looked cool. And
oh, shucks.
It became a very interesting text because there were so many voices out there. Witchcraft is non-hierarchical. There's 1,000 denominations. Witches do not like being told who they are. Starhawk once said in like the 1970s, witches tend to not enjoy joining groups, like by definition. So I was like, okay, there's no Bible. There's no Pope. What? Like there's no imam I can really go consult. I mean, there's the people who I think I should trust. And then I ended up using, it sounds like kind of glib, but I'm actually quite serious when I say the methodology I used was the best-selling books, because what the fuck else could I possibly do? The most historically accurate, literally, what the fuck does that mean in the context of witchcraft? It's a folk religion. So I went with what the folks were doing. And what I liked about your book is that your book kind of became this, like, this meta guide that was one layer up from the other books that was helping me kind of digest them a little better. It was like an aperitif or like a Tums. Maybe Tums isn't the best one, but it was like a companion helping me kind of interpret everything around me when things got a little bit stressful, which they did. So the context of your book in the witchcraft space became really clear and extremely valuable to me. I think we need more books like The Dabbler's Guide to be on. The Dabbler's Guide is great. I think it should like come with every book about witchcraft. You should just
I appreciate you saying that because I did write it not to be a 101 book, but to be a companion guide so that you can kind of understand where some of this stuff is coming from, why certain things are included, why certain things sound alike from book to book. Mm-hmm. Where some of this good information came from, where some of the bad information came from, and what to watch out for. It's context that we talk about, that people that have been doing this a long time talk about. Like I was giving an interview this morning and somebody was like, I had never seen UPG put in a book before. I had only ever seen it in blogs and comment sections and social media, you know, message boards and yada, yada, yada. I had never seen it in a book before until yours. Mm-hmm. I said, that's because we never put it in a book. There might be a book out there that has it in there.
I didn't see one.
I haven't seen one, but you cannot swing a black cat in a witchcraft message board without finding someone somewhere saying, well, this is my UPG. And I'm like, okay, well, if that's going to be that important to our community, maybe we should have a resource somewhere where people can be introduced to that concept and kind of understand what that means and how people use that. So that's why I created the chapters that I created, which are basically like, okay, so here's what I think your chapter, here's where I think you are in your reading. Mm-hmm. So here's all of the context that I would like you to know.
Right.
Here's all of the things that we're all talking about in the community about the chapters that you're reading. So
yeah, well, exactly.
I appreciate it that it did that.
Yeah, it was a good companion. Yeah.
Talking about books and talking about methodology, I was interested to see the list of books that you grabbed initially. And my good dear friend Meg did kind of steer you in a different direction a little later on. But I did find it interesting because you are so pragmatic. But the books that you chose, you did choose best-selling books, but for a religion that is a spiritual group that is as short-lived as ours is, and mm-hmm. has really only been publishing for a few decades, mm-hmm. like a 10-year period of publishing represents a massive shift in cultural conversation. Yeah. So I was so interested to see, yeah, you chose some of the best-selling books because of the pagan publishing boom in like the late 90s, early 2000s, created sort of the witchy literary canon. But it's so interesting because so many of those voices that you're referencing, I'm like, oh my God, nobody has read these books in like 15 yeah. years.
Which is what Meg said. She was like, what are you doing?
I was like,
you're in the dark.
You know? I was like, oh, you are having conversations that we had in like 2005 on mm-hmm. Witchvox. And I was so interested. So what did you find in one choosing that canon and then veering hard right into kind of stuff that had been published in the last decade? What did you, I'm just curious because I haven't been that person. I think it's so interesting to get a fresh perspective on this. What did you find yeah. had changed in the literary canon between that publishing period of the late 80s to late 90s versus what we're publishing now? Like, do you find that the conversations are the same? Do you find like what was your,
yeah,
not outsider anymore, but your newbie's perspective to the change in tone and publication?
I'm actually so glad you asked this because there's a little bit of this in the book, but I wrote so much more. And then my editor was like, you sound like you're writing a book report. It's not a book report. It's a memoir. And I was like, well, anyway, so we had to cut a lot of it. But initially when we started, I thought, okay, witchcraft is huge. It's really big. Why don't we, let's go with Wicca, because Wicca is a little older and has structure and some rules. So let's just start with Wicca. So I bought like the, whatever it was, like 10 or 12 or 15 best-selling books about Wicca. And then, as you mentioned, Wicca starts to fall out of favor in the early 2000s in favor of witchcraft. And that was around the time when most Wiccans were just calling themselves witches, but then there were a lot of witches saying, we're not Wiccans, please knock it off, right? And now I think most people today, if they are Wiccan, they will say they are Wiccan first before they say they are a witch, but maybe I'm incorrect about that.
Yeah, there was a big pushback for about 10 years yeah. there of, I'm a witch, but I'm not Wiccan. And they wanted, mm-hmm. people wanted you to know, I am not a yeah. Wiccan. I just have a goddess and god on my altar and I follow the wheel of the year and
not
I have elemental representations on my altar. But if you call me a Wiccan, I swear to God, I'm going to come kneecap you so fast.
So I did encounter, absolutely, that's a perfect characterization of this wave I encountered. It's like all of a sudden 2005 hits and people are like, Silver Waven Wolf isn't cute anymore. And I'm not a Wiccan. How dare you? There was almost this offense. And this is controversial. I'm going to get shit for this. I chuckle at that lightly because when I moved on to witchcraft versus Wicca, mm-hmm. I bought the top, whatever, 10 or 15 bestsellers mm-hmm. on witchcraft. Mm-hmm. All of those books are just Wicca light. They're yep. all written by fucking Wiccan. So I thought I was going into this whole new universe. And I was like, I am still in the exact same solar system.
The conversations on witchy social media at the time were like, could we get a book that isn't Wiccan or saying that it's not Wiccan, but it's just Wicca without the word high priestess in it? And the thing is,
right.
I think the reason that that happened with the distance that I have from it all was just, it was kind of the only game in town for a long time.
Yeah.
And you just get like
bored with the same old thing. Like, you want, I don't know, people get bored. People want something different. People want something new. That's about the time that traditional witchcraft started becoming popular, and we wanted to do nitty gritty late 1800s dirts and bones. Yeah. And it's so funny because you can actually see when the trends, when what will sell changed, because Silver mm-hmm. Ravenwolf no longer wrote Wiccan books. She started writing like hedge writing books, hedgecraft. Yeah. And I knew when that book was published, I was like, oh, the trends have changed.
Right.
Now we're doing folk magic. And we're doing folk magic. And then it was traditional witchcraft. And then I think Wicca came back in favor. And now we're back to folk magic again. So everybybody's doing folk magic again.
Thorn
Mooney's been talking about this on her socials.
I love her. And she is such a great resource. Yep. I really do love her TikToks. I loved her books. And I love her TikTok. And a Wiccan. And she has really, I think, beautiful like thoughts about the difference and whether or not witchcraft is a religion versus spirituality and Wicca versus witchcraft. She's great. But I think it's a little funny how much people want to distance themselves from Wicca. And it's not that Wicca isn't without its problems. You don't have to be a Wiccan, but to not acknowledge how much it's just colored the space of like European American magic is Western magic is just kind of bananas. And I mean, I do think something that's nice that's happening now, because if you're trying to do, okay, what am I actually trying to say here? I think if you're trying to become a witch, I think the journey is, I think you tend to end up trying to reach back into pre-Christian traditions. Now, if you are European American, if you are a white, then you're going back to Europe and you're basically just reinventing Gerald Gardner's wheel. You're grabbing what you can find, you're shoving it together, and you're seeing what works for you. And like, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but you do end up basically doing a lot of what Gerald did, which is to say, hanging out with the fucking Celts. You're suddenly obsessed with Ireland, maybe a little bit Nordic. Oh, wait, there's some white supremacists over there, so maybe not so much. And like, you're working with what you have. You're working with what you have. But it's very similar to what he did. Something I like that I'm seeing now is that there's also a lot of room being made, and I hope more room continues to be made, for witches that are not of European heritage, you know, like Brujeria is having a real moment right now. And I think it's extremely fucking cool. And it's nice to see some fresh material out on the scene. Yeah.
You liken Scott Cunningham to Bernie Sanders.
I do. I do. I stand by it. I do. I stand by it.
I don't have a question. I just needed people to know that in your book, you liken Scott Cunningham to Bernie Sanders.
Well, I'm not, again, not a historian, not pretending to be one, but based on what I gleaned in my writing, the impression that I got was that Gerald Gardner introduces Wicca. Wicca is very closed. You have to be initiated by a coven. And I believe Doreen Valiente and some other people were like, we should open this up a little bit. But then Scott comes out in the 80s and is like, I opened it up. You can don't need a coven. You can just work by yourself. Free healthcare for all. We're doing it. Student loan forgiveness. Fuck you, Gerald. And like he wrote the book. Like, I know a ton of witches who do not know who Gerald Gardner is. They all know who Scott Cunningham is because he opened the door. You know, 99%.
It's amazing how quick the history of a religion, a spiritual movement that is 70 years old mm-hmm. at the most on the outside disappears.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't all have to be historians, but yeah. Anyway, he's Bernie Sanders.
I'm going to read you a passage from your own book. Hmm. Quote, what are you looking for exactly? She narrows her blonde eyebrows at me, takes another puff of her cigarette. And then you respond, to feel like I had the power to make all my dreams come true, to feel like all the atoms in my body remember what it was like to be inside the core of a star right before it went supernova. That's cocaine, she replies, not religion. I remember being that.
Yeah.
I remember. So... It felt to me, because I remember being new, and this is something that I talk about in my book, not to make this about me, but this is something that I challenge new folks to ask themselves. Why are you here? What were you looking for? Which is a question that a lot of people end up asking you in the beginning. Because to challenge you a tiny bit, it didn't feel in the beginning like you knew exactly what you wanted out of all of this experience.
I didn't,
because from the title and some of it, I thought, okay, well, she's trying out being a witch for a year. And I thought I would be reading a book that was, okay, well, this month I'm going to do a spell to make it rain and see how many days it rains. And this month I'm going to da-da-da-da-da and try this kind of spell and this kind of spell and this different magical system and yada, yada, yada. There's actually very little witchcraft in the book, which surprised me a little bit. Not in a bad way. Just I just was surprised.
We did cut a lot.
Probably. I've been through that process.
I wrote a book that's double the size.
Yep.
I wrote a book that's double the size of the one that got published, actually.
So, and it does end up being, for a good chunk of the year, about becoming a non-Wiccan Wiccan. So my question, now that you've had time, I mean, now that you spent the year in a day, you wrote the book, you edited the book, you have sat with the book, other people have read the book. Looking back on all of this, what were you looking for?
Well, kind of what you just said. I had always been curious about witchcraft. There was a part of me that always felt like maybe I am a witch. In fact, I think I might be. But again, there is this massive wall of shame about that feeling. So I never let myself indulge it. So the book ends up being a lot about just trying to become comfortable. Where does that shame come from? Who'd I get it from? Why is it here? What's it trying to do? What's it trying to protect me from? And then what would happen if I actually tried to overcome it? And some successful things do happen. There are moments in the book where I feel like every cell in my body remembers what it's like to be in the core of a star before it went supernova. It doesn't happen often, but it happens because I think I wanted to feel the ecstasy of being interconnected with everything. I think I actually wanted to just say, I am an animist and I think everything has a life force in it. And I don't want to feel stupid for feeling that way. And of course, as a tiny little tiny person living in a planet that is full of climate change and wars and politicians, then I can like vote and recycle. It's you feel so fucking impotent against these giant forces that affect your life. And then here's this spirituality that's like, you can just change things with your will. Holy shit. Of course I want that. I'm a fucking Leo. Like, of course I want power, you know? So I did. I did. Those were the reasons that I did it. I think at some point in the book, I try to say it a little more succinctly in just the phrase, I was tired of God being dead. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be an atheist anymore. It's not comforting. I think it's a reaction to the toxicity of mainstream mass religion. Great. It's 2023. I think we're ready to re-examine it, though. I think we're ready to re-examine the state of God's death and what perhaps a resurrection could look like for a lot of us who think differently, trademark, and don't want to be associated with more toxic ancient religions. I did. I do. I do. I do want that for me. And I think a lot of other people want that too.
There is, I mean, I feel like we're all a bunch of white liberals here on this, this here podcast right now. And I feel as though that something that can inhibit folks who make a conscious effort to examine their privilege, to be aware of their privilege, to minimize the amount of harm that we do to try to be an agent of positive change in culture. Mm-hmm. One of the things that can get in our way is taking a moment to realize that we ourselves are not going to, one, fix everything, or two, break everything. I don't know how that happened.
What just happened?
I have no idea. I'm a witch.
I really feel like the universe really agreed with whatever you said. I just need you to
thank
tell
you.
Me.
Thank you so much. So
I didn't do that. I wasn't touching anything. That's amazing. Anyway, sorry. Keep going.
So you were kind of skittish in the beginning of your journey. And yeah. I understand, I think, where a lot of that comes from. I mean, you were coming on, you were doing this in the middle of 2021 is when you were experiencing your year. 2021
to 2022.
Yeah. That is mm-hmm. the height of witch talk. Witch talk was around for like 5 minutes, but you were doing mm-hmm. it right smack in the middle of witch talk, which was the invasion mm-hmm. of, like you said, teenagers with opinions in everybody's comment section, telling everybody who had been doing this for decades and decades and decades that they were actually doing everything wrong and that everything that they were doing was terrible and awful and bad. And they know because they read an article right. about it.
Right, right, right.
And so I understand being skittish, but there was a part of you, I'm going to get to a point here in a second. You seemed to walk into a room and apologize for being there before anybody ever noticed you were in the room. You walked into a room and apologized for being there. Mm-hmm. And there has been a moment in all of the many weeks that I have been slowly digesting this book that I cannot stop thinking about. And I genuinely can't believe you put in this book.
Okay.
Because there was a moment where you're doing a protection spell. I think it's like your first spell in the book.
Uh-huh.
And you imagine the moon and there's moonlight coming down, but then in your mind's yeah. eye, the moon goes away and you're enveloped in darkness. And you yeah. ask, and you came down with a sense of fear. And then you say you felt a sense of fear about all of the darkness, and you ask yourself if being afraid of the dark makes you racist.
Being afraid of the color black specifically,
yes,
not just the dark.
Makes you racist.
Yeah.
And I sat there and I had to put the book down for a second and I thought, now Diana Hellmuth, nobody thinks that. Nobody thinks that.
It was supposed to be a joke. I'm not sure it got read.
I thought, nobody is going to think that. And I get being the white liberal in the room and wanting to get out in front of a crisis before it happens. But I thought mm-hmm. it sounded at some point that like for the first few months, really, of your journey, do you feel like you were having a journey, or do you feel like you were trying very hard not to offend people by wanting to have a journey? And can I ask if it's the latter? Did mm-hmm. we, the people who had created all of the witchy social media, did we make you feel that way?
I mean, it's
I
more,
can't
it's
imagine
more the latter.
What it would be like. I can't imagine what it would be like to be starting a journey like this and going online to search witchcraft and just everybody's screaming at each other. So you're like, okay, well, I've already got this book contract. How do I do this in a way that isn't going to have a 50,000 teenagers screaming at me? So I get where maybe it right. came from, or don't let me put words in your mouth yeah. if that's not it, yeah. You know, let me know. But it did seem like for the first several months, which in my mind, I'm going back and remembering, okay, this is what was happening during those first few months. I remember all the fights. I was there. I was yeah. in it. I remember all of it happening. My book came out during that time. I remember that. So I was like, oh, well, this is what was happening that month. And this is what was happening mm-hmm. this month. And this was when these people were fighting and yada, yada. So I get why you were like a little terrified, but
yeah, I mean, yeah, you did say it pretty well. I was terrified I was going to start this journey and be told, how dare you, by about 50 million fucking people. I don't know. I was reading a lot of Rachel Ricketts. I was following a lot of social media folks who were also like, you know, is it witchcraft or is it privilege? Is it, you know, when Wicca stole from other cultures, it's racist, like everything. It was a time of strong call outs. And I'm not going to say they were wrong, but I am going to say they were floating in my head aggressively, and they were on top of everything that I was doing. And everyone is sick of white guilt. I'm not saying, like, look at me, someone forgive me for being white. But it probably did have an impact on some of the initial writings. I was terrified of being called ignorant, of someone telling me, how could you do X, Y, and Z? I was very afraid of doing a racism, because there was a lot of people doing racisms in witchcraft for decades. And I didn't want to be another one of them. I wanted to be smarter. I wanted to be better. I wanted to be a new voice that had absorbed a lot of the old material and learned from it, right? The joke about being afraid of the color black was supposed to be a joke, although I don't know if it came through. I think I had just read an essay about, like, black being a negative color and then a group of people being called black, and I forget who wrote it. But, you know, like, what does this color really mean in terms of, like, calling a population this? So it's probably it came from that, reacting to that. And also, I think when you're in this spirituality that is like, let's go back to your pre-Christian ancestors. Let's talk about your ancestors. And if you are white, which I am, that's complicated. And I had, it's actually not complicated. I think it is very normal to feel guilty if you are a white American for the things that your ancestors did to get you here. And I think if we have no guilt about that, I think there's actually something wrong with us. At the same time, nobody wants to witness white guilt. We're all a bit sick of it. No one is asking for white guilt. So I was like, okay, what do I do with this huge bucket of ancestor guilt that I have that people of color don't want to hear about, and a lot of white people don't want to hear about either? And a book that actually really, really did help me with that, I talk about it in the book, but not as much as I want to, was Lorraine Montague's book, Brujas, The Power and Magic of Witches of Color. She has so many amazing stories, personal reflections, suggestions for this process. That's not the book she meant to write, but that book changed my fucking life. It changed my relationship to white fragility and white guilt. And I think that book made me a better person. So yes, there's that side of it. There's the cultural appropriation and racism side of it. And then there was also just me genuinely being afraid to come out and be like, I want to write a book about witchcraft, and knowing 1,000 people were going to scream at me and be righteously nervous about how I was about to present their extremely personal spirituality and their concern that, depending on what I said, someone who didn't know them might end up thinking something about them, right? Because that is how these things work. So,
oh, sure. I mean, yeah, I'm somebody that's named guilty in your book a number of times. And yeah. I was like, that's a strange experience.
And I mean, also, I'm just like an inherently guilty person who's kind of a people pleaser, and I'm always afraid people are mad at me. Ask my friends. So if that came through in the book, that's just my obnoxious personality, probably.
Only a little bit. But I mean, what was fascinating about it is I thought, well, God, I mean, I would probably act the same exact way if I were coming into it in my late 30s, having lived through everything that I did in the early 2000s and wanting to come on and do everything right, capital R, but
yeah,
without being problematic and without getting screamed at because, oh my gosh, watching the mob come for people. But then what I kept wanting to do is like reach through the page and tell you nobody can be mad at you because you're not in charge of anything. Like you're, right. Well, yes, there is an inherent privilege that comes with a publishing deal and you get a bit of a platform and that immediately confers legitimacy on people that's oftentimes unearned. But you're not presenting your book. You're not presenting your book to be a teacher. You're presenting your book to be, well, I wanted to do this for a year. I wanted to scratch this itch, and I wanted to take you all on the journey of what it was like to do this for a year with me. And that's all this is. And I wanted to reach through the page and say, nobody's mad at you because you haven't done anything. Like you literally you'll walk into a room and say, hi guys, I'm Diana. I am so sorry for being here. I am so, listen.
If I could turn around and have not walked into this room just now, I would. But unfortunately, I'm here now and I'm everybody's problem and I'm so sorry. And can't we all just get along and don't be mad at me? And it's like, whoa, 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 whoa.
I mean, that's just my personality at base level. That's just too high.
But there seems to
be... We're working on it, you know.
There seems to be a release of that skittishness around day 200. Mm-hmm. Where there is a conversation with your sister that happens around day 200 in which she asks you how you know what you're practicing is real. And you find yourself defending this spiritual path, this newfound spiritual path of yours, despite the fact that for the previous 199 days, you have been convincing yourself that this is all fake. But suddenly you find yourself like defending this and feeling like a part of the community and not apologizing for doing it. And something seems to have happened somewhere around day 200. What was that? Where did that come from? And did it surprise you?
It did. And it happened in Salem. And I have some mixed feelings on Salem, a lot of which are not
popular. We all do. Hi, we all do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's actually...
It is a tourist trap.
I'm sure I can't be the only person who raises their eyebrows at Salem, who also, like, identifies as...
It is a vaguely historical tourist trap.
Right. Right. And I was kind of like... Like, what the fuck am I doing here? Like, everyone who was here who was accused of witchcraft wasn't a witch. But, you know, as Lauren said, witchcraft needed a homeland. It, you know, in America, that's seemed like it's a good one.
Everything that we think Salem is was invented in the last few decades.
Exactly. Exactly. And at first, I really kind of turned up my nose at that. And I was like, this is all fake. It's like Disneyland witchcraft. Nah, nah, nah. And, you know, just being an ass. And then when my sister kind of challenges me with that and says, well, then what are you doing? I think that was the moment where I actually realized I was, in fact, a neo-pagan. I'm no longer trying to go back. I'm no longer trying to find perfect history. I'm no longer trying to find the books that, as Ronald Hutton says, I'm probably not going to quote it perfectly, but, you know, books that not only contained power, but had power unto themselves. Like, I'm never going to find a black flame candle. Nope. I'm never getting a letter to go to a magical school. Like, this is never fucking happening, but I like this. Okay. It's a path to the future. It's not a path to the past. It's never, I mean, it can be a path to the past. If you feel like you're connecting with your ancestors, doing really traditional magic that you know is traditional, God, I love that for you. I want that so fucking bad. I just don't think I can have it. So, but I want this. I want to be a neo-pagan. So fine. I think it's a path to the future. I don't think it's a path to the past. There's too many missing pieces. We don't want to go to the past anyway. And we're never going to agree on what it was. So how about we just take what we have here and we take it forward? That sounds pretty cool to me. I actually would really, really like that a lot. And what if we all just stopped arguing about what they were really doing at Stonehenge? Does it matter? Like, how much does it matter versus what we're doing now? And everything you feel there now is still valid regardless of what they were doing in the year negative 1000, you know? And that felt really good. Like, I felt like I just released a lot of tension about what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And I just felt confident. Yeah. For like the first time in 200 days. Does that answer your question? Sorry.
Yeah. You know, Thorn Mooney talks about this a lot. She and I have had these conversations where it's like, if you know, a lot of people get into this because, again, they want the dusty tomes. They want they want to touch a chord that links them to the past. They want to engage with the Margaret Murray fantasy of being part of this long, unbroken line of witches that reaches
legitimacy
pre-Christian Europe. Exactly. Because the ancient history provides legitimacy. Oh, it's been around for 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. Great. Then it's been around for 1,000 years, because saying it's been around for 70 years doesn't sound as legitimate. But yet the thing that I love about Thorne and other folks like her that are like, listen, I'm Wiccan. I fully acknowledge that most of what I believe was invented at a kitchen table in the 80s. 100%.
Totally. Yeah.
And yet it works, and it makes me feel things when I do it, and I feel a sense of fulfillment, and I don't want to stop doing it. And I can acknowledge that it's a modern religion, and yet somehow also I'm getting something out of it. So maybe it's worthwhile anyways. Yeah. And you finally reach that point where it's like, okay, listen, I mean, I'm going to get out of this what I can get out of this, and I'm going to acknowledge that it is what it is, but that what it is beautiful and magical. Yeah. And leads me to reignite a childlike sense of wonder that you hadn't felt in a long time.
And it doesn't need to be 100% agreed upon, historically legitimate in order to be those things. Because we're just never going to get that. Yeah. Yeah.
That being said, I was a bit shocked.
Okay, here we go.
By your immediate, if not begrudging, acceptance of the law of attraction as a rule of the universe and of magic that all of us believe for some reason, you do state repeatedly throughout the book how anxious of a person you are. Did you find this thoughts are things and I can't think too hard about something bad or it'll happen to me philosophy as a natural integration of that anxiety? As like a...
Oh, yeah.
Well, I am a naturally anxious person. I want everything that I do to be a reason to kill me. So the law of attraction, that works. All of my thoughts are trying to kill me. That seems
great way
natural
to describe
and
anxiety.
Right. I'm sitting here like every time you keep talking about, oh, I'm this rational person. I think these things through. I, you know, all of this science and logic and yada, yada. And yet, the law of attraction comes up in your book a kajillion times, and you're just like, well, I guess I made my chicken die.
Well,
I guess my brain killed my chicken with my magic thoughts. And I'm like, babe,
I don't think I killed my chicken, but it did cross my mind. I mean, I kept running into the law of attraction. And even when I didn't run into it explicitly, I ran into it called something else.
Mm-hmm.
And even when I didn't run into it, I did frequently, mostly in the older writings, but Scott Cunningham said, does Scott? Okay. Silver Ravenwolf says this. Juliet Diaz says this. So basically like the oldies and the newbies, a lot of them say you have to believe, you can't doubt, and your thoughts have extraordinary power. And they mean this in an empowering way. And me turning it, when you put it on the law of attraction and it's like the things that you think are going to happen, then very quickly you end up, yeah, basically giving yourself generalized anxiety disorder via magical thinking, which is a documented thing I discovered. Mm-hmm. It's not even,
that's
I was
why
like,
I spend
why is
so
this
much
happening
of my book
to me?
Telling and, you, that's why I spent yeah. so much of my book telling people, don't become paranoid. If you become afraid of this, stop it. Stop right now and examine what you're doing.
Yeah. And then I talked to several other witches who say precisely what you are saying, which is not everything you think is a spell. And it's perfectly fine to doubt, as a matter of fact. And, you know, then, of course, that's the, for lack of a better term, magic trick for actually getting your brain to have less intrusive thoughts and be less paranoid, is accepting of the fact that these you will have intrusive thoughts and you will be paranoid sometimes, you know, because trying to push it down just made it worse. But something I think I would personally like to see more of, and people are saying this, I guess I just wish it was more popular, is not that thoughts are spells, but that it's okay to doubt, and not every thought you have is a spell. You're not that powerful. You're just not that powerful. You know, you didn't kill your chicken by thinking about it.
You are not
a
god.
You didn't kill your chicken by thinking about
you
it.
You did not will
not
terrible
god.
Things yeah. into existence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what I love is there's a part in your book that it really encapsulates that even the most logical, even the most atheist, even the most I don't believe in any woo-woo crap at all, da-da-da-da-da kind of person, right. that person, this like magic is not even a little bit real. And then you tell your boyfriend that you summoned a demon, and he says, I am an atheist. I am not an idiot. This is the beginning of every 80s horror movie. Like, is the demon gone? Yeah. Is the demon gone? Did you send the demon away? So what was it like in your life around these super logical people? And did you find that even they have their own superstitions and folk beliefs and stuff? You know, you do talk in the book a lot about how as people found out that you were a witch or getting witchy, that suddenly you get what all of the rest of us get, which is, hey, can you do a spell to find my, hey, could you do a spell to fix my landlord's doing requests. A thing? Can you get, yeah, you start taking requests like you're a magical
like you're
DJ.
A deli.
But what I find so interesting is that it goes in the reverse as well, where it's like, okay, well, you did witchcraft around here. Is the thing that you did gone? Are we good to sleep here tonight? And it's like, why does it matter? You don't believe in it. Okay, but is the demon gone? The demon you don't believe in? Is the demon that you don't believe in gone? So yeah. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, I don't remember who, but someone once said to me that atheists and neo-pagans, and I do lump witches under the neo-pagan umbrella. I realize some people might not like that, but for simplicity, that is how I, in conversations like this, categorize them. Someone said neo-pagans and atheists have the most in common across the religious spectrum because, you know, they both tend to be interested in the earth. They tend to be liberal and they tend to want to fight hierarchical power. So I think these people often end up in the room together. Ironically, perhaps not so ironically from that angle, but I needled my friends about it because I'm a fucking asshole. Like when my friend who's an extreme atheist, I mean, she hates all of it. She hates astrology. She hates crystals. She hates all religion. She doesn't like witchcraft. She's like, you want to ask the tarot cards? Because when you have a problem, this thing that you can't prove that you're pretty sure isn't real, but really you don't think about that obsessively unless you're like Bill Maher. You can't prove it. You can't prove it's right. You can't prove it's right. And then you have a problem and you go, well, I can't prove it's wrong. And then all of a sudden the doors open and maybe you're just, it's harmless. It's harmless, right? So that's one angle of it. And that little voice that goes, it's harmless, allows you to play. And I think it's fine. You know, I support it. I'm not going to be like, oh, you're still an atheist because you wanted to ask the tarot. Not a piece of shit. But something I think that's also true, and wiser people have articulated this better than me. We are spiritual beings. We do crave this. We do. It's in there. And I mean, I think even if you're like, I don't. You do. And you don't have to act on it. You don't have to do anything with it. I'm not telling you how to live your life. If you're happy, that's awesome. But I just think this is actually what makes us different from animals. It's this. And so to pretend that it is not there at all is just a little silly. But people get defensive. You know, they knock on wood. And you're like, oh, so you are superstitious. They fucking panic. It's like you called them a member of the Westboro Baptist Church. I mean, people are so, a lot of coastal liberals are very afraid of being called religious. So, and with reason, and I try and be respectful of that, you know? So I used to be one of them. Yeah.
There is a part in your book after Stonehenge, around Stonehenge, after Stonehenge, where I saw myself years ago and I was like, oh, there's a baby witch right there where, and I don't know a single solitary person that didn't go through this phase and doesn't at least still have some of it in their gut somewhere where you just suddenly get really mad at the church. You just get, you're just so mad at the church. Uh-huh. You're just mad. You're so mad at the church. And he's like, oh.
Real mad. Yep.
All of these pagan spaces were destroyed in the name of Christ.
What was lost?
His house is everywhere. In every city, you're talking about Jesus's house. Mm-hmm. You come to the part of your journey into witchcraft that everyone does, where they get angry at the loss of a culture they were never a part of.
Yes, so, well said.
Thanks. I'm a writer. Wow, that was dickish.
No, it's perfect. Don't edit it out. Keep it.
Looking back, how has distance reframed that conversation and anger for you? And I'm so sorry, I know this is a compound question, but do you ever get to the point where you realize that you can't fit a mountain into a church?
Ooh. I'm not totally sure if I know what you mean by that. I think I know, but can you break that one down for me?
Sure. So, well, I want you to answer the first part first, and then I'll clarify what I mean.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, it wasn't the first time in my life that I'd been angry at Christianity, and I wanted to make a little bit of room in the book for just this idea that, like, everybody used to be pagan, and what would history actually have looked like if the Roman Empire did not convert to Christianity and then conquer all of Rome and then conquer all of Europe, and then Europe went out and, you know, colonized large parts of the rest of the world. What would we all look like? It's a fascinating thought experiment. At the same time, I don't think we're going to get anywhere by dunking on Christians. And I didn't want it to be a dunkathon. I mean, part of me feels like if you identify as a Christian in this day and age, and I'm like, it's on you to prove to me that you are not transphobic and racist and misogynist. I'm not saying you are.
To be fair, but like, if you identify as also true, I need the same exact assurances from you as well.
I do. I actually do. That is 100% true. Yeah. So I didn't want it to be a dunkathon on Christians, especially with the history of everyone thinking witches like consort with the devil, and there's this war between Christians and witches. Like, there are Christian witches out there right now, possibly listening to this. I see you. You're real. Like, the dichotomy is fake between Christians and witches. It is not fucking real. It's very old. I think everyone is sick of it on the witchcraft end. But I did want to nod to feelings of jealousy. You know, like, if I wanted to become a Christian for a year, the amount of like agreed upon resources I could have had would have been bananas. And I kind of realized that part of the reason that my journey was so difficult is just because of how much shit has been literally burned and lost and destroyed. And like, that's why it feels too big. You know,
I was wondering if you were going to realize that it was jealousy. And
it's totally jealousy.
At this, like, oh, well, they have all of these churches. And the reason I said, did you ever get to the point where you realized you can't fit a mountain inside of a church, is because for the rest of us, the natural world is our church. And I greatly prefer the night sky to a steeple any day of the week.
Yeah.
And I cannot imagine a place feeling more holy than the mountains of West Virginia. Or the creek by my parents' house, or a bonfire around Samhain. There is no church that can hold a magic like that. And I just wonder, when did you get to that point where you realize, oh, yes, I'm very jealous because they have all of these trappings, you see. Yeah, but I worship like the world around us, and that is so much bigger than a church.
Yeah. That's funny you say that. When did you get there? Because this is like a little bit cheesy, but as you know, my first book was about backpacking, mm-hmm. How to Suffer Outside. It's funny.
Wondering how the backpack lady missed this. How did the backpack lady miss that church is the, or the mountains are the church? How the backpack lady
missed that? I was a little glib.
Yeah.
I was being a little glib in that section. Like, I knew. Just kind of waiting for someone else to like affirm it outside of me. I found an old book of like poems and ramblings that I made in high school when I was backpacking for the first time. And like, this bitch felt so plugged in to nature. And I didn't even recognize myself. And I was like, I had this. I absolutely had this. And I understood this in a very uncomplicated way. I didn't need outside affirmation for it. And I, at some point, I think I lost it. I don't know when I lost it. And that's very sad. And to be honest, I think I'm kind of still working on getting it back. Maybe I felt like I was delusional. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, when I go backpacking, I very much do feel like I am entering a temple. And I get upset when people play Bluetooth too loud. I get very angry when people litter. Because you don't play Bluetooth in a fucking church and you don't litter in a church. Why are you doing this in mine? You know, like that really is how I feel. But there was something, I wish I had the book in front of me. I'm actually reading Desert Solitaire by Edward Abbey right now. And he, that book is not without its problems, but that his writings on being alone in Moab in the late 60s, even though he's like a little snobby in some areas, is really helping me reconnect with this 16-year-old girl I used to be who went into the Eastern Sierras and understood she was on holy ground and felt how delicious that was and how special it was and didn't need anyone to tell her if it was happening or not. She just understood. And I kind of miss that. And I hopefully I can get it back real soon with Edward Abbey. Yeah.
As you leave Stonehenge, you get to a point, it's, you know, I'm struck seeing these modern connections through your eyes, how this leaving Stonehenge leg of your journey seems to be less about what things are and more about what we want them to be, what a person wants them to be, and how, sort of like we were talking a few minutes ago, how there is still something very valid and valuable in this is what I want to get out of this. And that can be enough. But mm-hmm. It also strikes me that in that same section, you say you're looking around you at the majesty that is old Europe. And you're saying, oh, well, nothing like this exists in America, except you had That's already true. Gone to Salem. And you know that New Orleans exists and Taos, New Mexico and Burning Man and all of these other places and things that are in the United States. And these spaces exist in different forms. It's just none of them are ancient. We are currently creating legacy right now. Mm-hmm. And you're a part of that now because you've now written a book. So do you ever, which part of your journey, like, and I understand the impetus of like, I want to do this right. And I want to do this the right way. Do you ever get to a point where you say, well, one, even though you had talked so much about sort of the fallacy of ancient history, the fallacy of appeal to ancient history, we do always clamor for it, even if our conscious mind says that can't happen here. We do always clamor for it, and we compare things to the idea of being able to have that ancient lineage. Do you get to a point in your journey? Have you gotten there yet? Or do you think you can get there where we are not constantly appealing to that ancient history? Do you think that there is something that we lose by being people in the United States and not having a built-in infrastructure of ancient history to pull from? And the only history that we have is fraught with slavery and racism and built on the backs of people of color. And that's a thing that you struggle a lot with in your book. Mm-hmm. How do you connect with the fact that you have to be a spiritual person in the United States without the ease of being able to relax into a millennia of pre-established canon?
Right. Well, I am jealous of Europeans that they have
is it
that,
because
they
of their walkable cities and free healthcare?
It's a huge part of it that they're raised speaking multiple languages. Yeah, they have great public transportation. Anyway, but at the same time, I'm doing this because it's historically correct is always a fallacy because you never really know. You just think you know, based on what people with PhDs have found after digging up stuff they found when they were trying to build a new subway station in fucking England, right? So even what we know, we don't really know. It's just what we all agree upon. It's all fucking blockchain. you know, it's all watching. We're all just agreeing with things other people have seen or not. So I think, let me think here for a minute. I'm jealous of people that feel really sure about what they're doing because they feel it is historically correct. But this does kind of go back to, I realized for me, if I actually wanted to stay a neo-pagan, knowing I was never going to get the perfect history I craved. And by perfect, I mean that was agreed upon by a critical mass of people. Like something I really interrogated.
Something in a book somewhere.
Yeah. So, something I really interrogated in this book was, one, my own inherent guilt, which you picked up on right away. And also, how much I weirdly need outside affirmation to confirm something I feel inside of me. And this isn't something that makes me cool. In fact, I think this is the definition of what makes me fucking uncool. I didn't leave this book with that gone, but I do think I really touched the core of why witches are constantly seen as confident and unfuckwithable, whether they're like a hero or a villain or an anti-hero in the story that they're in. Because if you have to be constantly affirming your own truth because everyone around you is saying you're not doing what everyone else is doing, you are a rebel whether or not you want to be, and you have to stand in that ground. Someone who does that over many, many years is very difficult to fuck with. They are extremely confident. And I only did it for a year. I am not yet extremely confident and totally self-actualized. Fucking at all. I'm not. I need like 20 more years of this shit before I become these absolutely terrifyingly happy, confident, like elder witches that I see who I would like to be.
Babes, I'm 20 years in. 20 plus.
Are you still not there? Oh, so it's just in my imagination? Don't tell me that. Give me something to hope for.
Yeah, when I was growing up, when I was a teenager, I was reading all these names on book covers and stuff, and now I know these people, and I'm like, Oh, we're all just kind of making it up and hope, and not making it up in the sense that like we're all just like, you know, bullshitting our readers, but just like, oh, we're all faking it till we make it. When none of us are as confident as a reader would like to think that we are. Nobody is living that perfectly witchy life. Nobody. Not a one of us.
Well, and also springing off like the other half of what you were saying, I mean, specifically in America, all nations are founded on bloodshed. Period. America was founded on bloodshed and genocide and slavery. Yay. So I think to be an American getting into witchcraft.
America was founded on genocide. Yay.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. I will be editing that down and I'm going to put it right next to the part where you're like, does being afraid of the color black make me racist? Yay.
I present to you Diana Helmbeth, racist. But I do think there is something about being an American, being a white American in a religion that is very like earth-based, is about connection to land, is very animist, and is very into ancestry. So I know witches are talking about it. I struggled with exactly how to talk about it because I was like, okay, I really think part of a path of being a white-skinned witch in America is contending with the bad things your ancestors did, but also I have a complicated relationship to the so in being a witch for a year, in being white and of European ancestry and living in the United States, something I felt very compelled to do when I was going back into like the history of my ancestors, it's like, yes, there's Europe, but then I noticed I was just skipping over like 200 years of how white people got to America. And so, you know, not wanting to just indulge a ton of white guilt, but this witchcraft journey did inspire me to learn more about the land back movement, to invest in the land back movement, to be pro land back movement. I think a lot more about my connection to the land, basically, and what happened before I got here. And if I see neo-paganism not as something that is desperately trying to take me back into the past, but something that is trying to shape the future, I think about justice, and I think about reparations, and I think about the legacy I want to leave, the ancestor I want to be, and that's something I liked about it. It started to feel less like all of this was coming from a place of guilt and more just like, what can I do to actually be a force for justice? What can I do? What if the past isn't this perfect pre-Christian paradise? What if in fact it sucked and people were shitty to each other? And maybe I can make a better future or be part of a better future. So
that's a good aha moment for you, because there was something that you said earlier where you said, well, before Christianity, we were all pagan, but you're using the word pagan there in that sentence, like the dictionary uses pagan, which is anything that isn't an Abrahamic religion.
Right.
And not how people in 2023 are using the word pagan, which is this sort of diaphanous collection of earth-centric belief systems that are, mm-hmm. you know, 70 years old or younger.
Right.
Like people 3,500 years ago would not have called themselves pagan.
No.
In any sense of the word that we use now, of course, very few of them would probably have called themselves witches in the way that we talk about it now, which kind of all goes to that thesis of it's okay if all of this is new. It doesn't need mm-hmm. to be ancient. It doesn't need to be reclaimed in any kind of way, because there's really no way to make it perfect. So it's okay right. if we don't let perfect be the enemy of the good. Mm-hmm. You almost immediately backed away from social media witchcraft.
Yeah.
After the first few mentions of it, was that a conscious choice? Where did that get? Were you still on it throughout the writing process? What do you think? I've got a follow up question if you answer it in a certain way, but was that a conscious choice to back away from witchy social media while you were writing the book?
I didn't back away from it. I just don't think I quoted it very heavily because it was. Why didn't I quote it very heavily? I guess there is still this part of me that's like, if it's in a book, it's more trustworthy rather than just something sure. someone posted kind of randomly, which is also true. I mean, like, it's a tweet, not an essay. It's a TikTok, not my magnum opus. It's an Instagram reel, not this thing that I and several people spent years producing and really double checking and still kind of has flaws in it. Like, you know. When people put things in books, they tend to be more reliable and they tend to be more what the person really meant to say. But I didn't back off of it entirely, because I think a lot of people find out about witchcraft and are educating themselves about witchcraft via social media. I think if witchcraft has a Bible, it is the internet, the whole of it. I read that in the book somewhere and I stand by it. It's an autodidact religion. Like, we're all just learning from each other. So I didn't stay off of it. But I may have been quoting it less, because also some of the quotes in the books are just better. Yeah. But I want to stay on the trends, you know.
If I could encourage you, because there is something that you talk about earlier in your book, how I don't know what green witchcraft is, but I think I'm a green witch.
I looked it up later.
Yeah. No. But there is this idea that if something is published in a book, that it's probably at least a little better thought out, or at least a little better of what the person meant to say, or a little bit more cohesive or something like that. I would mm-hmm. encourage you to add one additional layer of thinking to that, which okay. is that for a lot of people, a lot of marginalized communities specifically, the reason why social media is their main platform to discuss their spiritual traditions, practices, things like that, is because the witchy publishing industry, such as it is, prioritizes whiteness and very specific types of introductory books. And it yeah. doesn't really make a lot of room for other voices or other types of discussions. So, you know, a book about brujeria these are newer in the US canon, because so many of these traditions are oral and so many of these traditions are regional, and so many people not necessarily think that these are like closed traditions or closed practices or things that other people are not allowed to learn. It's that people want to make sure that their community continues to be centered in the conversation
as others learn it. And we have seen where other people have tried to publish books about brujería, curanderismo, santería, that kind of thing. And they all seem to be white ladies in the California suburbs.
Hi.
Who don't actually have any kind of cultural connection.
Yeah.
And you know, seem to be publishing to make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are just very, very protective of that. So that's this twofold thing, right? Where Llewellyn, Weiser, you know, the handful of pagan publishers prioritize a very specific type of book combined with a, you know, a bunch of communities, a bunch of cultures that would love to see their culture recognized in book form, canonized in book form, so to speak.
Yeah.
Given that air of legitimacy, like you were kind of referring to, which is what a lot of people believe, that the minute that something becomes published, it's a lot more legit. You know, there's an air of legitimacy to it.
Yeah.
But these cultures see what these companies do when they are allowed access to information. They see who they publish and how that work ends up getting turned into a book. And so these people are very protective of it, and they want to protect it and make sure that it's done in a certain way. And these two groups are only just now trying to find a way to play nice with one another.
Mm-hmm.
So if I could encourage you, not to say that you're necessarily wrong, because there's a lot of legitimacy in what you say as well. You know, a lot of people have to be very considered, not considerate, yeah, but we have to be very considered with what we say whenever we know that something is going to be in a book forever. We have to really mean it. Mm-hmm. We have to really mean it. But there are a lot of people, a lot of cultures that are oral, that are familial, that are regional, that can't have a seat at the table or are very wary of having a seat at the table. So that is another intersection to consider.
Well, and also to piggyback on that, I was wary about talking about any witchcraft that wasn't Wicca-based, precisely because I think I'm white. I mean, this is a book about a white lady doing like European-flavored witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
I touch on other things where I am invited to do so. I have the opportunity to like interview a friend who was kind of like both vaguely Wiccan and also like very much invested in her family's Haitian voodoo. And I think she's like a fascinating person to just talk to. I wanted to write about a lot of other branches of witchcraft, but there, I mean, I was, while writing the book, I was like, I can't do them though. I don't think I'm supposed to write that book. I think someone else needs to write The Witching Year for voodoo, for mm-hmm. brujeria, for, you know, for, but it's, that's not supposed to be me. Yeah.
Yeah. I get that. And there's entire chapters that were cut out of my book, 'cause I thought, you know, this conversation needs to be had. And I really hope that someday somebody is going to write, do this topic justice, but it can't be me.
It can't be me.
It can't be this face. It can't be me. I'm going to.
It can't be me. Yeah.
There's a part in your book, it's not the very end, but it's close to the end, where you say, it isn't a perfect recreation, but that's okay. I don't want it to be. And I thought, oh, welcome, Diana.
I have that reaction welcome. From a lot of very seasoned witches who are like,
welcome.
She got there. She got there.
She finally got there. And I was so proud. I was so proud.
Thanks.
I was like, oh, she did it. Good. She finally got where she needed to go. I was so proud. So I think that oftentimes we discount the experiences of people who are newer to something because obviously they haven't been doing it a long time, right?
Mm-hmm.
But people that are newer maybe don't necessarily, you know, they're not the experts in the room. They may not need to be at the front of a classroom or something like that giving instruction, but there is still quite a bit that we can learn because they are coming to subjects with a very fresh perspective and have unique questions. So I'm curious, after your year and a day, what is something that you think the community does well?
Oh, God. This is What is something?
And I'm also going to ask you the opposite question. So just go ahead and be thinking of that. What is something that you think the community does very poorly?
So I'm like, am I a piece of shit? Because the only thing I can think of is everything I think the community does poorly. I'm trying to think of things the community does well. I think with the community, you know what? Actually, the reason I'm having trouble with this is because I don't really have an immediate witchcraft community. I still feel like I observe witchcraft communities. Like I observe witch talk. I observe certain people's covens that I'm not really a part of, but I went to some of their ceremonies, but I'm not in them.
I'm going to say something to you that you said to me on social media a couple of days ago. It's so funny that you are surrounded by dear friends who are themselves witches, who invited you into this journey, who you have used as a resource, who are more numerous than most people have, and still somehow think you don't have a witchcraft community.
Well, I don't do witchcraft with them. You know,
I don't do witchcraft with my friends, but we'd get together on the Sabbaths. They're my community. Oh my gosh, Diana. We got to get you a second year in a day. We got to get you a year in 2 days. Here's lesson number two. You're going to do a lot of shit on your own, but the community comes together for parties.
I think it's not like I pick up my phone and, you know, happy Mabon or Mabon, you know, yay, but it's, I haven't practiced with like a coven in years. And the last time I did, I still felt like, I write about this in the book, like I was just going through the motions. I wasn't really like as invested in it as I would be today, which I feel a little bad about. But I guess something the community does really well is just having you come exactly as you are. I've never had a witch tell me I'm not being a good enough witch ever. Which is kind of amazing because I'm sure there's always room for improvement, but no one, that's just not something I think witches say to each other. Not that all witches like each other, but the criticism volleyed isn't, well, you're just not a good enough witch. The way someone might say that about other religions, you're not a good enough Christian. You're not a good enough Jew. You're not a good enough Buddhist. I really like the radical self-acceptance of witchcraft, because when you practice radical self-acceptance, I think it makes it easier for you to be patient and kind with other people, even when they bother you. And that's a lesson I think we all can learn. I really like that witchcraft teaches you to take the entire human experience as sacred, not just certain tiny little parts of it. Like, I really like that sensuality is sacred when it's considered dirty in so many other religions, for example. Yeah, I think those are things witchcraft does really well. And at the same, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, and at the same time, like the exact same side of that coin for me is consensus and most... witchcraft has no consensus. And if you're someone who likes a lot of external validation, that is unpleasant and stressful. Like if you are not someone who already kind of enjoys being a rebel, witchcraft, you probably might be doing witchy stuff, but you will never identify as a witch because you don't want to be transgressive. You don't want to be a fucking edgelord. You light candles. You talk to the moon sometimes. You pray a little bit. You're superstitious. You think there are these witchy things inside of you. But because witchcraft is still associated with rebellion, you might not ever really get any further than that. And I think that's kind of a bummer. I don't know how to change 2,000 years of associating witchcraft with transgressiveness and rebellion. But again, I think there's something to be said for neo-paganism and green religion more broadly, because I think it's a little bit more inviting. Although maybe I'm just in denial about the fact that it is still extraordinarily rebellious. I just don't really enjoy being a rebel, like for its own sake. I actually really, really don't. I just don't. It's just not my personality.
What's been your time like after finishing your book? Are you still doing witchy stuff? Are you doing what's your takeaways after the book was done?
I am. Something I wish I did more that I still don't do more is just kind of sit and make time for simply revering the divine. Because I do that in the book, and I have an absolutely profound breakthrough spiritual moment while doing it. And I wish I made more time for doing that. Not asking for anything, not manifesting anything, not willing anything, just like getting into your younger self, you know, or what Starhawk calls the younger self, possibly to the divine self, to really just sink into the ecstasy of like being in the universe. Love that shit. And I wish I did it more. But I do still do it after the year.
It's going to take you a long time. A long time. And that's okay. Because there's going to be a lot of other periods where you're like, oh, I've got to be doing stuff.
Right.
I can't just abide. I have to be doing something. I have to do a candle about it. Or at the very least, I have to be doing a candle about it. But you get to a point after a while where the most you're going to do about it is lay in your hammock with a glass of wine and stare at the moon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's going to be what you do about it.
Yeah.
And you are going to come to a place of peace and a place of wonder and a place of marvel in the truest sense of that word. And when you do, you're like, oh, this is why, this is the there that's there, even though this is only 70 years old. This is the there that's there.
And there's such a there there. And once you get there, you don't care that it's only 70 years old, because the there is so there and it's so big and great. Yeah. And I'm glad I had that experience, because it feels like one of those things that's like, no matter what happens, that can't be taken away from me. And I will admit, when I really need something, I do a spell about it. I cast a fucking circle, I light a fucking candle, I talk to the whole thing, because I'm like, listen, it's not gonna hurt. You do the mundane actions, and then you go, I'm going to be in my bedroom for a half an hour. Don't open the door, no matter what you hear, you know, like that's.
And how many more demons have you summoned?
Zero. I know I did that wrong. I know I did that wrong.
I did love your adorable hawk spell. I was like, oh, baby, that's cute.
That freaks me out. Cute. That actually really did freak me out.
I was like, okay, but would Diana today tell Diana of 2 years ago, like, you did not kill your chicken? You seem to be very convinced you're going to kill all your chickens somehow. Like, you're going to summon a hawk to kill your chickens. You're going to think them to death. You're going to, like,
fragile. Chickens are very fragile. They die often.
I grew up raising chickens. I literally live on a farm.
They die like for no reason all the time. Like nothing. Actually, like honestly, plants. Like raising chickens, and I lived in a city, you know, but like having four chickens and just like how randomly they could die for no reason. I was like, no wonder farmers are religious. So much of this is just out of your hands. You have to be appealing to a higher power.
I did love, as somebody who's married to a veterinarian, I did love that you raced this chicken to a veterinarian as though that veterinarian is going to do anything for your chicken. And I just love that. And I love that the veterinarian didn't make you feel bad about that, but also that veterinarian does not know anything at all about chickens. They probably can't even treat birds, because you have to have a special license to treat birds as an exotic.
I called like five places.
Oh, did you go to an exotic pet?
It was like an hour and a half away, because they were the only place. I was like driving to central fucking California.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought you just looked up the nearest vet and went there, and I thought, oh baby, oh honey,
no.
You went to an exotic pet vet. Oh, you did right. Oh, look at you.
It didn't do anything. We did find out eventually. I mean, spoilers. We did find out eventually why she died. And it was like, it was nothing I did. It was
it's never anything you did. It's
from a wild bird. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. It's fine. You're fine. Your thoughts didn't do it. And then, but see, knowing that, are you still like, well, if I think too hard, I'm going to kill my aunt. If I think too hard. Okay, good.
No, I did. I backed away from that, and I was happy to do so. Well, because I have this self-awareness at some point where I was like, I'm driving myself insane. This cannot possibly be correct. this cannot possibly be what I am supposed to be doing. I don't think being paranoid is a mark of a successful witch. Okay. And I started talking to other witches who were like, no, your thoughts aren't spells. We know the law of attraction isn't, if you dig it on the surface just for a minute, you realize it's actually really, really problematic. And also it doesn't quite work that way. At the same time, I do believe in manifestation, which is very close to the law of attraction. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. they bleed into each other a lot. But no, I no longer think thoughts are spells. There's a woman at the end of the book, Raven Hinojosa, who told me something that I absolutely loved. And she also let me be free of a lot of my doubt, which was by saying, I'm not articulating this very well. She said, if you want something, if you put that energy out into the universe, even if you doubt it, it doesn't matter. If you throw a stone into a pond and you doubt the stone, is it still making ripples? And that was the metaphor she used. I liked that. I actually liked that a great deal. So, but yes, I no longer think I'm killing anything with my mind. And I mean, I have moved recently and I was pretty paranoid about my pets running away because that tends to happen when people move, but I don't think that has anything to do with witchcraft. It just has more to do with animal psychiatry.
So what's your takeaway? What are your conclusions? What did you find?
Well, this is kind of echoing something I said earlier. I like that witchcraft is growing in popularity, even though I know it's irking a lot of people. And I dislike that witchcraft is associated with rebellion. What I found in modern witchcraft is basically a modern spiritual movement that is self-directed, deeply self-forgiving, that creates confident, empathetic, kind people who are really, a lot of the time, focused on the earth, which needs some fucking help right now, that are very into racial justice. And that needs some fucking help right now. And I'm like, here is a green religion, to quote Oberon Zell Ravenheart, that I very much think could lead us into the future if we would like to hop on board. I'm not saying you need to stop being a whatever you were born as and are happy as, but like, everyone should be fucking around with witchcraft. I promise I'm not trying to tell you a sham wow. Like, I know I sound like an infomercial, but I had many moments during this year where I was like, I urgently need everyone I know to also be doing this because it will solve all our problems. How do I do that? And then I'm like, no, this is the trap. Religious people proselytize and then everyone hates them and then makes jokes about them and you will have no friends. You can't do that. And I was like, right, I can't proselytize. I can't proselytize. But I want to. I really want to. Witchcraft is going to solve all your problems. Basically, that's my takeaway. It really will.
The Witching Year, a memoir of earnest fumbling through modern witchcraft. Witchcraft will solve all of your problems. Diana Hellmuth.
Yeah. Put it on the flag, put it on the money. Yeah.
So as we wrap up, tell people where they can find you, what you're doing next, anything you want people to know.
I am on TikTok and Instagram and a little bit on Twitter at Definitely Not Lost is my name. If you like The Witching Year, I did also write a book called How to Suffer Outside, A Beginner's Guide to Hiking and Backpacking. That is more prescriptive than memoir. It is a how-to. The Witching Year is not a prescriptive book about witchcraft. It is just me romping through a spiritual experience that hopefully you find delightful, maybe relatable, maybe you feels like gives you permission to go on your own. Yeah. Follow me. Cool. And if you read the book, actually, I do like hearing from people. If it had any kind of impact on you, please tell me. I think writers love that. We do. Make our day. Write us a letter. Oh my God.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And blessed Samhain, new witch.
Blessed Samhain. It's coming up. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. Seriously. Thank you.
And that is going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks to my guest, Diana Helmuth. You can get her new book, The Witching Year, everywhere books are sold. If you liked this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Consider sharing it with your friends on social media. Or you could also like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And while you're there, consider leaving a review. Reviews help bring the magic of this show to other listeners just like you. If you hate the ads at the beginning and end of each episode, consider joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and this month, they received a never-before-read chapter from my book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, which was referenced in Diana Helmuth's book, The Witching Year. So there was a chapter on like the 1,000-year evolution of the term black magic and where it came from and what it is and isn't. And so that draft chapter never actually got fully fleshed out and made it into the book. It ended up being cut, but just for spooky season as a bit of a celebration of the anniversary of the book, I released that chapter to my Patreon supporters. So you can sign up at patreon.com/headonfirepod. If you would like to connect with me on social media, I am at headonfirepod on TikTok and Instagram and all of the various social media presences. I am probably at headonfirepod there as well. Thank you all so much for tuning in and downloading the show. I hope that you all have a wonderful magical Halloween. This show will be back on Halloween, my favorite day of the year, so stay tuned. Thanks so much. And remember, never stop seeking illumination like a man with his head on fire seeks water. Be well.